hi, everybody. It's Kevin Stevenson. Thanks for joining me on this week's episode of I Don't Care with Dr. Kevin Stevenson. And I'm really excited about this week's guest, Dr. Brad Holland, who's an ENT physician here in the Waco area here in Central Texas. And Dr. Holland is also the president this year for the Texas Medical Association. So, Dr. Holland, welcome to I Don't Care.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I'm looking forward to talking with you.
Well, that's great. It's a real treat for me as well. So, Dr. Holland, let's go ahead and kick off a little bit. We're into a new year, into 2026. So, what are the Texas Medical Association's top priorities for this year?
Well, there's a lot of them, I'll have to say. You know, in general, medicine is still, I think, on its heels a little bit. Physicians out there are frustrated, and it's a changing time for medicine, and so we have so much on our agenda that tries to make the life of a physician easier and make it easier to care for our patients. Because, as you know, many entities, government, corporate, lots of different influences are starting to hinder what we consider the traditional physician-patient relationship and make it tougher to be a physician. And you know, I sometimes think if you took a physician from 1985, 1995, and showed them what we do today, they would could not believe what has happened to our profession in the last 30 years, and it has really changed. And so, you know, our priorities are those that make the life of a physician better, but make it easier to get access to a physician and make it easier to care for patients and try and remove those hurdles between us and medicine. Those things involve prior authorization is a very big topic for us because we spend a lot of time on that, trying to defend our profession against those who want to practice medicine who aren't physicians. We spend a lot of time on that. Just having the best medical policy here in Texas to, such that the government and our laws reflect what we think is our priorities in medicine. We are in constant flux on medical policy. And reforming education because our pipeline of new physicians is really at a critical low, and so graduate medical education being a big part of that as well. So that's a very brief overview, but I assume we're going to get deeper into the weeds.
We really are, and you've hit a couple of topics that we are going to delve into a lot more deeply. First of all, is scope of practice. Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about that, and I do, you know, occasionally do have some non-healthcare related folks listening. So explain scope of practice and talk about the major issues that you're seeing that here in Texas and really across the country.
Well, many people assume that if you are going to prescribe medicines, make medical decisions, code diagnoses, certainly even perform surgery, that you have a medical degree, MD or DO, and are licensed by the state. Increasingly these days, we are seeing activities performed by non-physicians. And that can mean traditionally physician assistants and nurse practitioners. In Texas, we have those kinds of folks operating under physician supervision. For instance, nurse practitioners can see folks at in primary care or urgent care or even in specialty care, but they are supervised by a physician. Same thing with physician's assistants. And so we have that level of physician supervision. But there is a push to have folks that don't have a medical license make independent decisions and prescribe and diagnose and do that without physician supervision. And we think that that's something that should not be allowed here in Texas. If you want to practice medicine, you should go to medical school. And so that's we very much appreciate the healthcare team. We think that the physician should be at the top of the healthcare team and that there should always be a physician supervising those who haven't gone to medical school, who are going to put a diagnosis on your chart, who are going to put it to your insurance company, or who are going to prescribe you medication. There should be physician oversight. And when you explain it that way, most folks are very comfortable with the fact that physicians are supervising. In fact, it's often assumed, but that's not the case as it is in 27 going down to 26 states now, where they've allowed independent practice of nurse practitioners. But let me tell you another problem that we have here in Texas, and that is that we have an explosion of online nurse practitioner training programs. And so they're taking some of our very best nurses, and of course we need nurses, but financially incentivizing them to go through what I think is a subservient training program, a 4-month online program, and then 700 non-organized clinical hours where you just have to shadow and then have someone sign a form saying you were there. And through that process, you can get an online nurse practitioner degree. Having never touched a patient, never seen anything about a diagnosis or clinical medicine, really in the flesh, it's shocking. You know, we require our beauticians and our barbers to have 1,000 hours of clinical training, and we only require 700 for nurse practitioners in these non-brick and mortar training programs. So what we really need to be talking about is reform of that training process rather than allowing independent practice at this stage. And that's the one thing that we are going to talk about this time around, is trying to standardize that nurse practitioner training, because it's become so haphazard. There really is no standard, and anybody can throw up a program and charge $50,000 tuition and churn people out. And that's starting to hurt our medical community in Texas, and hurting Texas patients.
No, I would greatly agree with that. And that extends to other areas, nursing as a whole, and some of our other technical programs. You know, it was exacerbated certainly by COVID and the inability to get that hands-on training. And so I talked to a lot of my nursing leader friends who say, the nurses that are coming out today just don't have that hands-on experience. And sometimes the very first stick that they've ever done has been on a patient in a clinic or a hospital. And you know, as a patient, you kind of expect somebody to have a little bit of practice before
Absolutely.
They come to you, you know, in the beginner.
COVID really did show us a shortage problems with the nursing, and those continue today. We need better nurses. We need more nurses. We can't, of course, lure them away financially to these other programs either. We need well-trained bedside nursing. It's just an absolute must for patient care here in Texas. And we are still short of nurses, and short of nurses as we're short of physicians. We need to have a better workforce. But the degree and level of training, at least, is much more standardized for nursing. There are standards, and there is none for a nurse practitioner. And that's something that needs to be remedied, and we're talking about that this legislative session with the legislators in Austin.
Well, and we touched a little bit upon you know, TMA's priority about expanding access to care. And I know, you know, in Texas, we have such a large rural expanse here, and we're really in crisis, particularly in and around access. And so I know in some communities, the only primary care, the only healthcare they have is a physician extender, a PA, or a nurse practitioner. And you know, I would assume that you agree that best model is, you know, with physician oversight, as well as I do as well. And so, but how can TMA help with that expansion of access, you know, in locations where, let's face it, physicians really don't want to, you know, live and work oftentimes in towns of, you know, 500, 1,000 people out in the middle of nowhere. So how can we best provide that care in our rural areas?
Well, one thing we certainly don't want to do is lower a standard in rural care that we don't have in urban care. And,
sure.
And so the idea of expanding access while lowering a standard is off the table in our minds, that the rural of patients deserve the highest level of care that is given anywhere. And so lowering that standard, I don't think is appropriate to say that we're going to relax the supervision of those mid-levels or nurse practitioners. I don't like the term mid-level, but nurse practitioners or otherwise. You know, we have good studies that show that no matter what kind of practice you have, it takes about 3,000 lives to nucleate a practice. And that's true for a nurse practitioner or a physician. So it doesn't actually increase the access just by lowering that standard. It can lower the cost a bit, but it doesn't actually lower the nucleating number of patients you need coming through the door to keep a practice open. And so that's one, I think, fallacy that we see. The other thing is that, you know, we've just released a study that shows that nurse practitioners are very much in favor of supervised care no matter where they are. 98% appreciate having a physician that they can go to that is called their supervisor. 94-95% think it's beneficial from a liability standpoint. All above 90% believe that is something that is important to them in their practice of medicine, that they have a physician who's overseeing them. So, you know, the push to do this is really not from the rank and file nurse practitioner. It's from some of their lobbyists, and frankly, from a lot of the healthcare companies who see it as a cheaper option, but it's not a better option for rural healthcare. You know, I think we need to do better getting folks into rural healthcare, mostly, I think, by way of loan forgiveness. You know, there is a tremendous opportunity there. because physicians are having such huge loans. And we've had some programs through the Public Health Service and otherwise that give some loan forgiveness for rural healthcare, but that program is not very vivacious right now. And so that's really, I think, the one answer that if we had loan forgiveness for 3 years of service in a rural healthcare setting, perhaps, most likely under a federally qualified health rural center, that would be a great way to get more physicians into the rural healthcare areas. The last thing I'll say on this, though, is that every study that's been done shows that if you do relax those standards, those nurse practitioners go to Dallas and Austin and Houston and San Antonio. They don't go to rural healthcare area easier. So it's really not an excuse to lower standards for rural health patients. It's not a good solution, but we do need good solutions. And I think loan forgiveness as well as incentives to attend in those rural healthcare settings is really the answer.
You know, I've seen loan forgiveness certainly work in other states where I've worked, Arkansas, Nebraska, being two, because and then you actually get that community buy-in as well. You know, the community may, the city, the county, whatever entity may also support that loan forgiveness, and oftentimes those physicians end up staying in the community. They become attached. They become a part of the community. And I like it whenever there's that, you know, that real sense of collaboration between not only the physician, but their community as well.
Well, everybody has some skin in the game that way, and they become vested and a relationship develops. And that's ultimately what leads folks to both physicians to stay and patients to want to go to that position is that the relationship. So we have many, many success stories with those kinds of loan forgiveness programs. And I think that's something that should be much more invigorated and supported from federal funding and state funding, potentially through some Medicaid and critical access funds to give, you know, provide loan forgiveness.
Dr. Allen, we talk a lot about the upcoming continued shortage of physicians. Yeah, what do you see as a solution to bringing more people into the practice of medicine?
First of all, I think that our number, the number of physicians that we need to be training really needs to be determined by our physician workforce commissions. We know how many physicians we need to train, and yet we are just locked with federal funding in terms of graduate medical education for medical school spots, for residency positions. We cannot turn up the volume. It's a complicated government process, mostly federal, that most people don't understand, but we need to be training more physicians. And it kills me to see highly motivated and skilled pre-med students here at our universities in Texas who want to be physicians, and there just aren't spots for them. And then we turn them away, and then we ask for foreign medical graduates to come in to fill the gap. And while I have nothing against foreign medical graduates, and that's been a good flow for us and something that's helped Texas, there's no reason why we should be turning away our own folks who want to be physicians, who are qualified, have the motivation, in the name of pricing, or really of cost savings to the federal government, and then doing this workaround that no one really thinks is the best solution. So, I think every year we ought to be saying how many physicians that we train in Texas. We're trying to get to that number and show people that every year we're calculating what we need to be training, and then the government's coming up short. And we plan to make that much more front and center to show them that, listen, this is the number of folks we need to be training. Of course, the number of medical schools in Texas has doubled. There was 8 medical schools when I finished medical school. There's 16 now. So we've increased some, but that's actually not commensurate with the demand. We're still way below. So I think organized medicine needs to do a better job pointing out the number that we need for our workforce and really making that public to those who are making decisions, legislators, federal and state. But the situation we're in now is sort of stopgap with allowing foreign medical graduates. Of course, that's been in challenge with H-1B visas, and many folks who are here who didn't train in the United States are on a visa for medical participation are in jeopardy. And I think we've got that maybe worked out, but the whole system's in question because of that process, too. So it just goes to show you we need to do better training our own here in the United States.
Well, you touched on prior authorization challenges. And I know as I age and access the medical system even more so, for me as a healthcare professional, it's very frustrating when you know, I'm getting denied for certain care or delayed, you know, certain care is being delayed by who I know is not a physician. So talk to me a little bit about those challenges and what's TMA doing about that.
Well, it absolutely is just one of the most frustrating things on a day-to-day basis. When you are following the standard of care as a physician, you're telling the patient what they need, you're trying to prescribe it or order, whether it's a CT scan or a medication or a procedure, and their insurance company says no. And, you know, even Mark Cuban pointed out recently, it's ludicrous that these plans, you aren't prior authorizing anything that you're not already on approved as a physician on their plan. So you're already on their plan. They've accepted you as a physician, and yet they're still going to tell you no when you request things. That really just doesn't even make sense on a very superficial level. But the amount of time that we spend doing this is increasing. Prior authorizations are not getting better. They're getting worse. More often than not, you know, I've had probably 10 prior authorizations scheduled in the last 2 months. You go through hurdles, you try and schedule a call. It takes, even when you schedule a call, it takes 10, 15 minutes to get through their phone tree, to get to the right person, whatever. When you finally get to where you think you're supposed to be, a peer-to-peer review with a physician, you don't end up talking with the physician. You end up talking to someone who finally says, well, we're going to go ahead and approve that. And so it was never a peer-to-peer in the first place. Almost 10 out of 10 of those have not been ever me talking to a physician. It's just a process that they put in place to delay and hoping that either you won't go through with it or just to delay care so that that's an economic benefit of them to not have payouts. It's a ruse, and we need to do better for the patient. It's a time suck for the physicians, and it's really the worst part of medicine, I think, in many ways at this point. We have gold card legislation here in Texas. In fact, we were the flagship state to pass gold card legislation, which I still am excited about, but it's not a working system. No one is really using that system right now because and the gold card system is this. If a physician is challenged 5 times by a health plan and wins every one of those, meaning that they've shown that they're providing the standard of care, then that physician is exempt from new prior authorization through that plan. The problem is that it is plan by plan. You know, the number of plans I'm actually on is too numerous to count. It changes on a daily basis. You jump on, jump off plans that you don't even know that you're doing. And so no physician knows whether they're actually gold carded or not. In fact, about 20,000 physicians are gold carded right now. And they don't even know it. We don't have a good way to communicate that. And it is plan by plan, and it's just too confusing. So I hope we have one of our priorities this legislative session is to try and smooth this out. I don't think it'll actually take that many tweaks because we've already done the work and passed the gold card legislation. But it is a non-working system now that really does need to be fixed. I think it'll be, once again, the flagship system that we had hoped for across the country. Several states have modeled their legislation after ours, and they're trying to get through this passed. We don't know what's going to happen at the federal level either because President Trump has indicated he has some appetite to take on prior authorization, but that still remains a little undefined and what he means by that. So we may be usurped by the federal system as it is. But at least in Texas, we have hope, and you can guarantee that we're going to be working to try and get the gold card system working because allowing us to take care of our patients, you know, that's really what we want to do. We know what's best for them, and we're following the standard of care. And a lot of these gold card reviews or I should say prior authorization reviews are done by entities outside the state that we can't regulate when even a Texas Medicaid plan, managed Medicaid or other managed Medicare plan contracts with a reviewer out of state that is not subject to the laws of Texas. It's just a bad system, and we're having a little trouble regulating it, but that's certainly one of our priorities.
Personal story for me, I was having lunch with a friend of mine last week, and he said, hey, you know, I've got a cardiac cath scheduled next week. And he told me that he did the CT calcium score, and it was a horrific score. And his cardiologist said, you know, we need to go in there as quickly as possible. So he has it on the schedule. So I was checking on him the day before and seeing how things were going. He said, it's been moved. The insurance company said, you know, we've got some other hoops and hurdles to go through. And so it's so frustrating. You know, this is a guy that, you know, he's very concerned, obviously, about his health, you know, and he got a little bit of a scare and wants to get it taken care of as quickly as possible, and yet his insurance company continues to delay. So that kind of, you know, transitions me into the topic of what can we do to break up the power of insurance companies? Because we see, you know, many insurance companies have gone into purchasing physician clinics. And so, you know, like United Healthcare is the largest owner of physician clinics or employer of physician clinics in the country. And so what can we do to break that power up?
Well, that's an affront to me that 1 in 8 physicians nationally is employed by Optum, which is a division of United Healthcare. And that's actually a number that's going up. Quite simply, we should not have allowed that. We shouldn't allow that. We need better from our legislators to break up the power of large insurance companies. I frankly think the best single solution is a fairly simple one, and that is just to remove ERISA protections and say that each insurance company can be regulated state by state. Whether they break up and have 50 different entities that's united, or whether they try and deal with each 50 laws, that is the one way. If we can regulate private insurance by our Texas Department of Insurance here in Texas, as opposed to having those exemptions, I think that would immediately be a quick turnaround. We need to have insurance regulated on a state-by-state basis as opposed to these large national entities that are too powerful and exempt from any of our Texas laws. They're just completely exempt because most plans are self-funded and have ERISA exemptions. And it's just the number of non-ERISA plans now, even here in Waco, is you know, very, very low. So I think that's one solution. But we cannot have this vertical integration of healthcare where the health system employs the physician, provides the insurance product, and then nowadays wants to have a facility or a clinic and may eventually want to have a hospital, or in some cases does. That vertical integration is just not good for anybody. And insurance is very powerful. They have a lot of say both at Washington, D.C. and in Austin, Texas. But people, we know that's not right. And legislators know that's not right. A physician cannot be both a patient advocate and a guardian of a limited resource, as in an insurance entity. You know that you can't wear both those hats, I don't think. And so on the outset, we should say that insurance companies should not employ physicians, and that was a trend that started poorly. Needing to speak to that every chance I get, that should not be allowed. Physicians should not be working for insurance companies when they're trying to work on behalf of the patient. And we do need critical reform. I get frustrated with Washington just because there's so many things that need addressing, and Congress is just not moving on this. Whether we have it as a unified health plan or health reform or individually, but we need Congress to be doing more in the healthcare realm, because it's just really kind of going untended and bigger and bigger consolidation, everything buying up practices, buying up physicians. We are getting so consolidated that's why I think we're having the explosion of price and really, in many cases, poor level of patient care because of these large entities where you become a number and no one benefits from the massive consolidation that we've seen.
Well, you're leading me into the next topic that I'd like for us to talk about, health system consolidation, because my gosh, you know, the number of hospitals that are just combining and we're getting down to, you know, 10 or so large systems across this country are controlling most of our hospitals. Let's talk a little bit about that. What do you think?
Well, you have to remember that this was sold to us that this efficiency, consolidation and economies of scale was going to save us money. And we have now run that experiment, and the answer is that's wrong. That is patently wrong. That is costing us more money. It's causing a lack of competition. There's upward pressure on prices instead of downward pressure on prices, and there's no price check. So I think we can say unequivocally that the consolidation, which, like it or not, for a very, very big plan that was passed back in 2010 in the Affordable Care Act, some good things, some bad things, but the consolidation, I think, was instituted with part of that, and has also then been part of natural market forces too. But between those two things, it's just produced a market that has consolidated. 90% of our healthcare markets in the United States are now considered highly consolidated. And so what does that do? Well, it pushes the prices up. So we don't need to sit here and scratch our heads about why our healthcare price is so expensive. I see more people spend more time on why do we spend so much money? And to me, it's a very simple answer. We have almost zero market forces. There's no checks and balances, really no capitalistic influence. No one knows the price of anything anymore because price is almost a NPV that is taken out of the equation in physician-patient relationships. And even in patient relationships with their insurer, the price is the most nebulous thing that anyone could ever talk about. So we're in a bad way on both consolidation and patient information on price as a consumer. And the natural consequence of that is these high prices, which everyone hates. But I think that therein lies the answer is we need more competition. We need more market forces. We need higher price transparency. And frankly, I think I'll go ahead and say we need to talk a little more boldly that employer-sponsored health insurance has really been something unique to the United States, which we have now run as an experiment since the 50s and has not proven to be beneficial. So I think we need to get back to having health insurance as a commodity purchased by the patient instead of all these entities between patient and insurance. That to me is the ultimate solution, is to have insurance as a commodity. And you know, we would be aghast if Geico had this kind of control over our cars, or State Farm had this control over our house. I mean, we wouldn't stand for it. And yet we have Cigna, Aetna, and United, and these players having tremendous control of our lives and health and our access and our finances. And how this happened, I guess you can look back and see, but we can fix it. You know, people think it's a nebulous problem, but we can fix it. We just need to break up these entities and involve a little more consumerism, but also make the patient the primary player. And that's really what we've gotten away from.
Yeah, it goes back to having skin in the game, because, you know, whenever and you know this as well as I do, whenever somebody purchases their insurance through their employer, now things are changing a little bit with co-pays and higher deductibles, but it's like, you know, I don't know how much it costs, so what's it matter? You know, I'm not going to question anything. I'm not going to shop for a price. I'm not going to look for, you know, if I'm willing to pay for higher quality, great. But oftentimes people don't have that option. And so I think it's just, I agree with you. I think taking health insurance out of the employer space and putting it back into the commodity space would be a tremendous solution.
Not every employer is in favor of that, but many would be, because it's a headache for them too. So I think we need at least to make an easier route for that. So maybe we don't move everybody at once, but there are ways to make that start happening, and that's what we need to be doing.
Yeah. Good. Well, in the last few minutes that we have, Dr. Holland, I'd like to talk about, you know, let's talk a little bit about physician ownership of hospitals. You know, share a little bit of that with my audience.
Well, it used to be the physicians could own hospitals. That was also part of the Affordable Care Act, was outlawing physician ownership of hospitals, thinking that was a conflict of interest. But you know, why is that a conflict of interest? I don't understand the thinking on that. I mean, if a lawyer can own a hospital, if a plumber can own a hospital, if an MBA can own a hospital, then why would a physician, of all people, not be able to own a hospital? We don't apply that kind of thinking elsewhere either. Is it a conflict of interest for a chef to own a restaurant? Of course not. Well, that's who should own a restaurant. And why we say something different for healthcare. You know, physician-owned entities, we're running that experiment because some were grandfathered in, and we can look at ambulatory surgery centers, which are allowed to be physician-owned, and they are generally the modicum of efficiency, lower cost, and higher quality. That experiment's been run, and we have ample evidence to show that it works. So, certainly there are facilities that are not physician-run that we can hold up and say are exemplary facilities, but taking physicians out of the game, it really didn't make any sense in the first place, and no one thinks it's a good idea. I actually think physician ownership would help a little bit with rural healthcare. It wouldn't be the complete solution, but allowing physicians to have individual ownership in some of these entities may actually spark a little more investment and eye to small markets where there's niche. So I think it's a solution to allow physician ownership if possible, to overturn that law. And allow physicians to run what the business that they know, the efficiencies they know, the business that they're in, and they do have the patient's best interest at heart, and so by all means, we're fighting for physician ownership of hospitals.
Well, Dr. Holland, it's been a real pleasure having you on I Don't Care today. I've really enjoyed it. And so, any final words from my audience?
Well, in this era of medicine that has become so complex, and frankly, there are shortages of physicians, it is too tough to see a physician. We know that. And we want to make it easier for patients to get in to see physicians, because we really think that the physician-patient relationship, which is a protected legal entity, but it's also a relationship we take to heart. Having that relationship with your personal physician, whether it's your primary care or specialty physician, those relationships are what drive physicians to go into this in the first place. It's what warms our heart, and it's why we do this, is to be patient advocates. So we want to make it easier for patients to see physicians. We value that relationship. We protect that entity. There's no other relationship like that defined, and it is a sacred trust between patients and physicians. So I encourage every patient out there to have that relationship. I'm a patient too, as well as a physician. I know how important that is. You receive better care when you have a relationship with your physician. So I encourage everyone to see a primary care physician, develop that relationship, and any other physicians that you may need involved in your care. It's what makes the medical world go around in my mind. It's really the basis for healthcare. And if we make that number one, we're going to be a lot better off to make the physician-patient relationship the center of everything we build our system around, instead of corporatism and insurance and all the things that it has become.
Well, Dr. Holland, thank you so much for joining me today on I Don't Care. It's been a real pleasure, and would love to have you back on in the future to talk about further priorities for TMA and anything else you want to talk to.
Other than the fact that it's spring and we're getting ready for the legislative session next year, a lot to look forward to, a lot of changing entities, a lot of changing laws, but the Texas Medical Association is there to look out for patients, and I'd be delighted to come back anytime you'd have me to talk about these issues.
Well, I appreciate that. Thanks so much, Dr. Holland. Folks, help me thank Dr. Brad Holland, President of the Texas Medical Association, and we will see you next time on I Don't Care with me, Dr. Kevin Stevenson. Thanks.